It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We're working to separate facts from rhetoric on some recent history. It's the 2006 health care law in Massachusetts.
That law, which includes a mandate to buy health insurance, is the biggest achievement of then-Governor Mitt Romney. As a presidential candidate, Romney has defended the law. He's also struggled to show how it differs from President Obama's health care law, which Romney and other Republicans attack.
Beneath the rhetoric is the law's record. We heard yesterday that it's widely accepted in Massachusetts, but it left some work for Romney's successor on health care costs. Here's NPR's Richard Knox.
Two out of three people in Massachusetts think the state's 2006 health law is a good thing. Among the other one-third are self-employed businessmen like Fred DeFinis. He sells parts for playground equipment.
I'm what's called a non-employer firm. That is, I am my only employee.
Massachusetts has almost a half million businesses like his. When DeFinis gets together with some of the others, the talk always turns to the soaring cost of health insurance.
We go around the table and we say, what was your increase this year? And nobody's talking about 10 or 15% increases. We're always talking about 15% and up.
To keep his premiums down, DeFinis bought a plan that doesn't cover prescription drugs.
Well, and lo and behold, the next year, the mandate for prescription drug coverage kicked in, and I was hit for another $100+ a month to buy some coverage that I didn't really need or want.
Massachusetts officials decided prescription drugs should be included under the new law, which was passed under Republican Governor Mitt Romney. But the law didn't do anything about the cost of coverage. It was already among the nation's highest. When Democrat Deval Patrick took over the governor's office in 2007, he called together top insurers, hospital executives, and doctors to talk about controlling costs.
I finally lost my patience because they'd sit around the table and everyone would start their response the same way. Well, Governor, they'd say it's complicated.
The insurers would point to the hospitals would point to the doctors would say it's malpractice suits. Patrick says he got more and more fed up.
I understand it is complicated, but the point is we have to stop being defeated by that complexity.
So 2 years ago, the governor directed his insurance commissioner to turn down the latest round of premium increases because they were excessive. Not every state has this power. Insurance companies were outraged, but Andrew Dreyfus of Massachusetts Blue Cross Blue Shield says it was a turning point.
Unquestionably, when the governor imposed caps on the premiums that we could charge a small business and individuals, that was a pivotal point. And I think it sent a message to the entire healthcare and business community that we had to change.
Since then, a lot's happened. Insurers tore up their contracts with hospitals that called for annual increases of 8 and 10% and negotiated agreements that provide 3, 2, and even 0% increases. Blue Cross Blue Shield, the state's largest insurer, has persuaded some of the state's biggest hospitals and thousands of doctors to accept a new kind of payment. Instead of getting paid every time they do something, which encourages them to provide more and more services, they're paid a fixed amount each month for each patient. They also have to show they're not cutting back on quality. Dreyfus says a third of the company's 2.8 million subscribers are now on these so-called global payment plans.
I'm pretty hopeful that most of the state will be on a global payment system within the next 2 to 3 years.
Governor Patrick says the health insurance marketplace is changing.
We've got some more work to do here, but average premium increases were almost 17% 2 years ago. They are less than 2% right now.
He says Massachusetts needs to pass some legislation to lock in these changes and go further, cut down on administrative costs, reform the malpractice system, and other steps. The big idea you hear being talked about these days is to hold total health spending to a target tied to the state's overall economic growth.
What I want to assure and why I think we need legislation is that it's sustainable, that we don't continue to have increases above the rate of growth in the economy, so that over time, without a check on that, healthcare eats up everything else.
Legislators are expected to come up with their own ways to do it this spring. But no one's talking about repealing the state's 2006 health law. Not even Fred DeFinis, the businessman we met at the top of this story.
I'm not sure that I necessarily want to see the law repealed. What I want to see is some balance on the cost side of the equation.
If Massachusetts can do that, it might become a national model again. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston.
Talking electronics, such as computers and iPhone apps, have dramatically changed day-to-day life for people who are blind. But some advocates for the visually impaired are concerned that good old-fashioned reading is falling by the wayside. More from Colorado Public Radio's Megan Verlee.
Like a lot of iPhone users, Rolando Terrazas can seem glued to that shiny chunk of glass and metal. and mostly for the same reasons everyone's hooked. Email, text messages, finding a decent coffee shop. But Terraza's phone does a bit more.
So, we're going to go to Money Reader right here, double tap.
Terraza's waves a bill under the phone's camera.
Let's see what this one is.
$20.
Having an app to tell money apart can be a big help for blind people like Terraza's. It means they don't have to just trust clerks to give them correct change. Terraza's is 19, and his daily life is full of useful technology like this. But it has a downside.
All through elementary school, I used Braille. But when I got a laptop, I switched over and I went away from Braille. If you don't use it, you lose it. And that's what happened to me.
He uses software that reads out loud what's on his computer screen. These days, Terrazas is slowly relearning Braille as a student at the Colorado Center for the Blind, south of Denver. It's late afternoon at the center, and one of the instructors is logging in using a Braille typewriter in the lobby.
What time is it?
The center puts a lot of effort into convincing students they still need Braille to be independent and employable. Director Julie Deedon says that technology is making the 200-year-old writing system more accessible than ever. Deedon shows off an electronic reader about the size of a paperback.
When I was reading Tuesdays with Maury, and so I can go right into the book.
Instead of having to lug around massive volumes of printed Braille, she just sweeps her fingers over little plastic nubs that rise and lower with each line of text. Deedon worries smartphones and such mask a serious problem, Braille illiteracy.
People will let it go, and they'll say, well, you know, they're not really illiterate. They just don't really use Braille or print very much, but that's just because they're blind. I think that it's kind of an out, and technically, they really are mostly illiterate.
Blind people choosing not to learn Braille is only one part of the equation. Chris Danielson with the National Federation of the Blind says his group is increasingly butting heads with school districts trying to get out of their federal obligation to provide a Braille teacher.
They will tend to say, well, we have screen magnification software, we have all these tools available, and in light of that, we don't think it's necessary for a blind person to be taught Braille.
The Federation estimates that today only 1 in 10 blind people can read Braille. That's down dramatically from the early part of last century. Jackie Olette never thought she'd learn Braille since she lost her sight as an adult after an operation. Standing in a cafe in a Denver suburb, Olette says learning to read again was the last thing on her mind.
When am I ever going to use Braille? I'm never going to sit down and read a novel in Braille. You know, I'd rather download an audiobook from iTunes, you know?
But last year, Olette was getting her yoga instructor certification. And during those classes, it became apparent that having a mechanical voice reading off her teaching notes didn't make for a very soothing yoga experience.
So I realized, you know, there is a use for Braille, and I think everybody uses Braille in their own way. You know, I think that everybody finds what they need to use Braille for.
Advocates for Braille are hoping blind people like Olette will continue to find enough reasons to keep their tactile system of writing alive, even amidst the growing chorus of computer voices. For NPR News, I'm Megan Verlee in Denver.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, automatically backing up computer files for individuals and small businesses worldwide. Learn more at carbonite.com.
This is NPR News.
And hard to follow that, but we'll try. In a typical school year, about 600,000 students drop out. Some eventually return to school or get GEDs, and some head to their local shopping mall. For school. Yes, the shopping mall. Christine Jessel of member station WUOT explains.
Knoxville Center Mall is one of those regional malls that's seen better days. There's still a JCPenney and a Sears, but in between, there are a lot of empty, closed-down stores. And then there's the high school, where Kelsey Jones just got her diploma.
Well, at first, people are just like, wait, what? When you're in the mall, you're like, oh, I'm in a mall. But when you walk in here, it's like a totally different atmosphere. You don't even feel like you're in a mall.
The school looks more like an office than a mall. There are small conference tables, beige walls, and several vending machines.
Good morning, Will.
Hey, Miss Chloe.
How are you doing today, baby?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing well.
It's not the kind of alternative high school you might first imagine. Brett McKenzie says these aren't troublemakers. The recent graduate says a lot of these students might have otherwise dropped out because they fell behind. But then they were given this option.
You get your list of classes, all the stuff you have to finish, like all your credits.
You have three classes a day, and you just sit and you work at your own pace.
You see that division sign up there?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to change it to multiplication. What happens to this second one?
You flip it.
Okay, very good.
The students here take the same classes and standardized tests as those in traditional high schools, but the education style is different. There are no class lectures. The instruction is personalized. Long before the morning shoppers arrive, students come up to math teacher Janice Clark's desk for one-on-one help.
This tells me that they're both going to be positive.
Yeah.
Okay, so plus and plus.
And
then
A
squared.
Mall employees of Simon Property Group created the Simon Youth Foundation to try to improve education across the nation. And at the same time, it also gets more people into the malls. The foundation focuses on at-risk students who may be homeless, ill, or working full-time to support their families. The group donates the space rent-free. Foundation President Michael Durnell says the local school district pays staff, buys supplies, and sets the curriculum.
It's a real degree. It's not a GED. A lot of our kids are looking at military as a career. A lot of our students look at a two-year certificate as a career opportunity. Some go on to the four-year school. But these kids are making life-changing decisions just by getting that degree.
The first mall school opened in Texas in 1998. There are now 23 in Simon malls across the U.S. with a claimed 90% graduation rate. The foundation plans to expand, including Atlanta, Chicago, and Los Angeles. Mall schools do have critics, but Dan Dominich of the American Association of School Administrators says the criticism centers on location, not the programs.
Whatever number of students you succeed with is more than you would have had otherwise. And so when you're doing something like this, there is no downside. It's only the benefit that you have been able to save and keep in schools and achieve your goal of providing every child in your school district with a high school diploma.
Some districts let students earn class credits working in mall stores. Others don't. And even though these are public schools, the foundation does set some guidelines. Districts must cap classes at a 15-to-1 student-teacher ratio, much lower than the national average. For graduates like Brent McKenzie, who'd fallen 2 years behind in classes, the formula works.
Without the academy, I would not be joining the military. So without this school, I wouldn't be much of anything. With this school, I'm going to be making money one day.
McKenzie says he's looking forward to a future he wasn't sure he'd have a year ago. And now he says he has the best gift he's ever gotten at a mall, a high school diploma. For NPR News, I'm Christine Jessel in Knoxville, Tennessee.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
And let's head to the private sector, where not everybody is destined to start a business, but Silicon Valley executive Reid Hoffman argues that even employees should act like entrepreneurs. Hoffman's new book, The Startup of You, argues that people should adapt to changing jobs and actively work to change the jobs they do.
You're never a finished piece of work. You're always learning new important things. And everyone should think about that, everything from themselves as a worker to also companies, to industries, and even to countries.
Hoffman argues you can learn how to change and grow by building relationships, networking. And by this, the founder of the networking site LinkedIn means a lot more than just posting your resume online.
Don't just always go out to lunch with, you know, a couple of your friends, but actually go out to lunch with people from other departments, from other companies, and explicitly address questions like, how do you see the industry changing? How do you do your job effectively? Is there anything I should learn from that in terms of how do I do my job effectively? Do you see interesting opportunities? And that's not necessarily always a question of job transition. It can be. Those kinds of talking to other people, building those relationships are, I think, the things that everyone needs to be doing.
You know, it's funny. I bet someone is going to listen to this and say, you know, if I went into my boss at my workplace and said, you know, I went out to lunch with this guy from another division or another company entirely and came up with this interesting idea, that they would say my boss doesn't want to hear that.
Well, then your boss is not really adapting to the modern world.
Time to look for a new job at that point, I suppose.
Well, that would definitely be one potential consideration. I mean, just look at how industries are transforming, you know, in years, not decades. What's your response to it? You know, are you just going to hope that somehow companies and governments are going to figure it out? You've got to take proactive responsibility for that. So, you know, part of what your prospective boss should get on board with is getting the ideas about how to adapt and how the market's changing, how the industry is changing, is critical for the organizations to survive and thrive, and also for individuals.
You try to tease out the difference between meaningful and not so meaningful business relationships. What kind of relationships would you want to have?
Well, I think the really key thing for people is to realize that relationships are like alliances. You say, who are my allies in life? Who would I help and who would help me? And in those things, those are the folks who say, hey, let's get together for a lunch on Saturday and let's talk about what are the ways that we can learn and be more effective.
What do you say to people who just feel kind of creepy about that kind of activity?
Well, I think there's a natural human instinct to think, doesn't that feel manipulative or something? And the answer is, well, actually, ask yourself the question, just like, for example, in a friendship, how do I be a good friend, right? Or, you know, how can I help people? How is this a genuine relationship? That's then okay. That's not manipulative. That's thoughtful. That's proactive. And the reason it's not creepy is because what you are being is genuine about caring for the other person as part of thinking about how do we build this alliance.
There is a whole collection of people, and you, of course, are one, who have gone on to big careers in Silicon Valley that have some past connection to PayPal, the software that people use to buy things online.
That's right, the so-called PayPal mafia.
Describe it.
PayPal was a really intense company founded by Peter Thiel and Max Levchin, and later added on by Elon Musk with the acquisition of X.com. What it was is a whole bunch of young folks who built what has now become a global payments, you know, OS, a global payments service, operating system for OS, sorry, Silicon Valley speak. And what happened is the whole company kind of grew into this global phenomenon on a three-year basis and was purchased by eBay. And so there was a whole crew of very young entrepreneurial people who then went out and started other companies, like Jeremy Stoppelman started Yelp, Max Levchin started Slide, I started LinkedIn. There was kind of like a little mini Nova explosion of folks jumping out to doing other entrepreneurial activities.
And so have you ended up having alliances with these people of the sort you've been describing?
Absolutely. We all knew each other. We all trusted each other. So we started, like, when each of us started companies, we'd talk to each other. We'd say, who should I approach for financing? You know, how should I put my PowerPoint deck together to pitch venture capitalists? You know, who would be good people to get involved? Do you know of a good person to hire here? And, you know, part of the reason I think there's been such success from the PayPal crew has been that we were all really intensely helping each other with all of these classic entrepreneurial problems.
Reid Hoffman is co-author of The Startup of You. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
The Pentagon hopes to save about $500 billion through budget cuts over the next decade. The military budget released yesterday plans to achieve some of those savings through downsizing, which means the Pentagon is going through a kind of corporate restructuring. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, those plans have sparked opposition from Congress and from communities who worry about losing jobs.
When the Pentagon says cut the budget, military towns around the country get nervous. Take Fort Wayne, Indiana. The Air Force plans to shrink the 122nd Fighter Wing, where Air National Guard pilots fly A-10 Warthogs. Mike Landrum, president of the Greater Fort Wayne Chamber of Commerce, says that base means a lot to the surrounding community.
About $58 million of economic impact. And if you total up the reservists plus the civilian, state, federal workforce there, you've got a combined total of about 1,200 folks.
Now, it's not certain just how big the cuts to this Air National Guard base will be, but overall, the Air Force plans to retire over 200 aircraft, including a lot of A-10s. And Air Force cuts in the coming years will fall disproportionately on Guard and Reserve troops. Retired Air Force Lieutenant General Mike Dunn explains why.
The Guard and Reserve really have not been reduced much in the last decade, while the active forces have been.
In fact, back in 1990, the Guard and Reserve made up 25% of the Air Force. Now it's up to 35%. Air Force officials say it's simple math. The Garden Reserves have to shrink more than active duty forces. But many members of Congress say if we're cutting the budget, grow the Guard. A part-time airman costs about a quarter as much as a full-timer. Republican Lindsey Graham of South Carolina took to the floor of the Senate last week to recall the Guard's service in Iraq and Afghanistan.
When you go into the combat theater, you can't tell the difference between Guard, Reserve, or active duty member, which is a testament to all three.
And Democrat Patrick Leahy of Vermont said the Guard and Reserve represent the kind of military the country needs as the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq come to a close.
Turn to our historic roots as a militia nation. It means we should return to the constitutional construct for our military in the days we maintain a smaller standing military.
Senators Graham and Leahy promised to fight these cuts. Concern about the unsung role of the National Guard led to the creation of a seat on the Joint Chiefs of Staff this year. That move came over the objections of the other branches. General Craig McKinley took his post on the Joint Chiefs on January 1st, maybe too soon to assess whether he's having an impact. Retired Major General Gus Hargett, head of the National Guard Association, says he thinks the Guard does need better PR. He realized this when he flew a mission a few years back to Uzbekistan.
I was met on the ramp by an active Air Force wing commander. They had 16 C-130s sitting on the ramp. Every one of them belonged to the Air Guard. But there was nothing out there that ever said, okay, we deployed an Air Guard wing.
In the end, Guard supporters will also have to argue they fit into the Pentagon's new strategy for a smaller, more nimble force focused on the Pacific and the Middle East. Retired Air Force Lieutenant General Mike Dunn says Guard and Reserve forces are not designed for every mission.
Remember, these guys have civilian jobs, and while they're patriots, you know, they are militia. They are supposed to be a reserve, not a primary response force.
The Fort Wayne, Indiana Chamber of Commerce is mounting a letter-writing campaign to fight the cuts to the 122nd Fighter Wing. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta and members of Congress should be getting plenty of messages as these cuts hit home. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. Now to the sprawling desert of eastern Washington state. The Hanford Nuclear Reservation is home to millions of gallons of radioactive waste left over from World War II and the Cold War. These days, it's the federal government's largest environmental cleanup project, and it's become a big headache. As we hear from Anna King of the Northwest News Network, the problems center on a massive nuclear waste treatment plant.
Builders didn't have the final blueprints when they broke ground on Hanford's treatment plant about 10 years ago. They still don't. It's a sprawling complex of high-rise buildings growing out of the desert's sagebrush and sand. The $12 billion facility is a little more than half built, but it's still being designed. Scott Samuelson oversees the project for the Department of Energy.
Design build is the course that was selected a long time ago with how to do this.
Now, it's not clear if design build was the best plan. The hope was the design as you build would help clean up the 56 million gallons of radioactive sludge faster. But now, federal watchdog agencies are calling into question the way the project's been handled. They're worried about key components of the plant, like its pipes and mixing tanks.
What could ultimately happen is that the plant won't operate, and the plant ends up being a monument, an albatross sitting on the Hanford horizon.
That's Walter Tamasitis. He used to lead a team tasked with solving some of the most complex engineering problems on the project. But Tamasitis claims the government contractor he works for took him out of that position more than a year ago after he raised concerns. He says the plant's mixing tanks are unsafe.
The major things that can result is that you have a hydrogen explosion at the top of the tank, and or you have a uncontrolled nuclear reaction at the bottom of the tank.
Right now, the waste sits in tank farms, as they're called. The exhaust systems emit an eerie hum. The sludge is the leftovers from making plutonium for bombs. Already the tanks have leaked radioactive waste into the ground, and they're just miles from the Columbia River. Another possible problem with the plant is its piping system. The Department of Energy's Don Alexander is a top scientist on the project. He says experiments and data show that the plant's stainless steel pipes might leak.
On a scale of 1 to 10, with the hardest metal being a 10, the one that can resist erosion the best being a 10, the metals that were selected for the plant are about a 2.
Alexander says top managers haven't heeded his warnings quickly enough. The Energy Department has launched a formal investigation into his claims.
Right now, what we're doing is managing our way through that the best we can.
Hanford project manager Scott Samuelson says these concerns won't slow down construction.
Even if you did it another way, you would still have discoveries along the way that you had to address.
The Federal Defense Nuclear Facility Safety Board plans a public hearing about the design and safety issues facing Hanford next month. Critics, including the safety board, say the longer the Department of Energy waits to change the design, the more expensive the project becomes. For NPR News, I'm Anna King in Richland, Washington.